where he kissed it many times. "This is the land," he chanted gravely. "This is a man's home. This is good land to settle upon, a good land on which to have children. Here we shall bring our ancestors. Here we bring our gods." Behind him, in the prow of the canoe, stood Tupuna, his face upraised. "Tani, we thank you for the safe voyage," he whispered. Then, in penetrating voice, he called, "You unknown gods, you brave and gentle gods who hold this island, you fine and generous gods of the Smoking Mountain, you 40 gods, you 40,000 gods, you 40 million gods, allow us to land. Allow us to share your treasures, and we will honor you." He was about to step ashore with his own gods, but the idea of invading a new land was too overpowering. So he shouted once more, "Terrible, all-seeing gods, may I please land?" He stepped upon the land, expecting some awful omen, but none came, and he told Pa, "You may bring the rock of Bora Bora onto its new home." And the shark-faced warrior leaped ashore with the only lasting memorial of home, a square of rock. When he stood beside the king, Tupuna cried, "Now you, Teroro, with your spear." But when it came time for Teroro to leave the canoe, he did not worry about new gods. He placed his two hands on the prow of Wait for the West Wind and whispered as gently as if he were speaking to Marama, "Beautiful, lovely ship, forgive me for cutting away your glory. You are the queen of the ocean." And he leaped ashore to guard his brother in the next fateful moments. Tupuna left three warriors at the canoe to guard it, while the others strung out in line and formed the solemn procession that would invade the island. At the head of his nervous column marched Tupuna, and whenever he came to a large rock, he begged the god of that rock to let him pass. When he came to a grove of trees, he cried, "God of these trees, we come in friendship." They had gone only a short distance inland when a passing cloud dropped misty rain upon them, and Tupuna shouted, "We are received. The gods bless us. Quick, see where the rainbow ends." It was Pa, holding the stone of Bora Bora, who saw the ark come to earth, and Tupuna cried, "There will be our temple." And he hurried to the spot, crying, "Any evil that is here, Tane, push it aside, for this is to be your temple." The foot of the rainbow had fallen on an inviting plateau overlooking the ocean, and Tamatoa said, "This is a good omen indeed." Then he and his white-bearded uncle began their search for a high male rock, for both knew that the earth itself was female and therefore polluted, but that solid rocks of impermeable stone were male and therefore uncontaminated. And after a long search, he found a large protrusion of male rock coming erect out of a fine reddish soil. And when Tupuna saw it, he said, "A perfect site for an altar." So Pa placed upon this male rock his slab of Bora Bora stone, and with this symbolic action the new island was occupied, for upon the flat stone Tupuna reverently placed the fine old gods Tane and Ta'aroa. Then he climbed back to the sea with a coconut cup which he filled with water, and this he sprinkled over the temple area, over the gods, and over every human being who had come in the canoe, flicking it into their faces with the long finger of his right hand. "Now let us purify ourselves," he said, leading every living thing into the ocean. King, warrior, pig, chicken, and breadfruit bundle. In the cool sea, the voyagers replenished themselves, and a canny woman cried, as soon as the job was done, "Do you know what I stood on? Hundreds of shellfish." And all who were purified fell back into waves and began routing out succulent shellfish. Prying the sweet snails loose, they popped them into their mouths and grinned. When they were satiated, Tupuna announced, "Now we must design the temple." and the slaves began to tremble. The old man led everyone back to the plateau, and while they watched, he and Tamatoa laid out the four sacred corners of the temple, and large piles of rock were collected about deep holes which the farmers dug. The king signaled his warriors to bury the four quaking slaves, but Teroro prevented the sacrifice. Placing himself before the slaves, he pleaded, "Brother, let us not launch our new island by more killing." Tamatoa, astonished, explained, "But the temple must be upheld." "Tane doesn't require that," Teroro argued. "But we have always done so." "Isn't that why we left Hawaiki and Red Oro?" "But that was Oro," the king rationalized. "This is Tane." "Brother, I beg you, don't start this killing." Then, remembering how his best men had been sacrificed, he pleaded, "Ask the men." But this was not a question on which Tamatoa could take a vote. It concerned his relationship to the gods. Perhaps the entire fortune of the voyage depended on these next few minutes. "Your words are ill-timed," he said stubbornly. Tupuna supported him, grumbling petulantly. "From the beginning of time, temples have been held up by men." "Bury the slaves," Tamatoa ordered. But again, Tororo spread his arms before them and cried, "Brother, don't do this thing." Then an idea came to him, and he pleaded, "If we must sacrifice Tane, let us sacrifice the male pig." For a moment, the idea was appealing. All knew that Tane loved pig sacrifices more than any other. But Tupuna killed the suggestion. "We must keep the boar to breed more pigs," he said flatly. And all agreed. But Tororo, impassioned by his desire to start the colony correctly, cried, "Wait. Long ago, when we had no pigs, we gave Tane Ulua, the man of the sea." When Tamatoa looked at his uncle for confirmation, the old man nodded. "The gods are pleased with man of the sea," he admitted. "Give me half an hour," Tororo pleaded, and he took six of his best fishermen, and they waded onto the reef and cast their lines, and Tororo prayed, "Ta'aroa, god of the sea and of the fish that live therein, send us Ulua to save men's lives." And when they had caught eight, two for each corner, they returned to the plateau, and Tamatoa looked at the big, handsome fish and said, "For three of the corners, we will use the man of the sea, but for the essential corner, we will use a man." "Please," Teroro began, but the king roared in anger, "Silence. You are in command of the canoe, but I am in command of the temple. What would Tane say if we begrudged him his due?" So, in anxiety of spirit, Teroro left the scene, for he would not be partner to what was about to occur. And if the priest and the king conspired to kill him for his offense, he did not care. He sat on a distant rock and thought, "We flee an evil, but we bring it with us." And he knew bitterness. When he was gone, the king said to Mato, "Bury the fish," and they were placed in three of the holes. Then he directed, "Mato, bring us one of the slaves." And the warrior went to the six who huddled apart and said bluntly, "I am sent by the king to select one of you to be the spirit for the temple." Although the slaves are gratified that only one had to die, they were anguished that the choice of that one was forced on them. Looking at one another, they asked, "Which of us shall go to die for our masters?" The six wept, and one who had a position of leadership finally pointed and said, "You, perhaps." The man identified gasped and steeled himself for his ordeal. First, he moved to the leader who had named him and rubbed noses with him, signifying that he went to his death with no hatred. Then he rubbed noses with the two other men, saying to each, "It is better that of the two of us I should die. Between you and me, good friend, it shall be I." But when he came to the second woman, whom he loved, and when he rubbed noses with her for the last mournful time, he could not speak. And he marched from her to the pit, where he was thrown in, with the stones crushed down upon him, and where earth was pounded about him and over him, and where, in silence, he met dark death. When the consecration of the temple was completed, and when manna had again begun to flow from the gods into King Tamatoa so that he could function as king, Tupuna organized his second expedition, and with all save four, who guarded the canoe and the animals, he probed deeper into the unknown in search of food. It was not a productive journey, for there was almost no food available. They did come upon a fern whose inner core was just barely edible, and to the fern Tupuna said, "O secret god of this sweet fern, we are hungry. Allow us to borrow your trunk, and we will leave the roots so that you will grow again." They came upon a taller tree than any they had known in Bora Bora, and Pa observed, "One tree like that would build a house." So Tupuna reverently prayed, "Mighty tree, we need your wood to build a house. Please let us borrow your strength. See, I plant at your roots a rich ulua for you to eat, and when you are finished, may we come and use your wood?" If they did not find food, they did come upon something almost as good, a cave well up from the reach of the sea and dry. At its entrance, Tupuna buried his last ulua and prayed, "Gods of this cave, please take away any dark things you have left hiding here. Allow me to sprinkle holy water that this place may be sanctified." Then he entered and called back, "This will be our home." At this point there came a shout of laughter from the shore, where the pigs had been turned loose, and it was obvious that the old boar still had sea legs, for he would take a few steps, wait for the canoe to surge beneath him, adjust his legs to meet it, and then fall snout first into the sand. Looking dazed, he would grunt loudly and adjust his wobbly legs for the next roll, only to fall on his face again. The watchers roared with glee and forgot the haunting uncertainties that perplexed them, for the infuriated hog brought them the therapy of laughter, so that when Tupuna cried, "Move everything to the cave," they responded willingly, and in labor ignored the danger threatening all of them that in their new home there might be no food. But when they got to the cave with their burdens, two farmers reported, "There are many birds on this island, good ones." And, as if to prove this claim, overhead flew a line of terns, which ate clean, fresh fish, so that when baked, they tasted like delicious chicken and bonito mixed. Tamatoa, looking at the terns, said, "Tani would never have brought us here if there were no food. It may not be the food we have known, but it's here. Our job is to find it." Now, with the temple established and the gods at home, with the great canoe properly beached and all treasures stowed in the cave, the hungry men who had completed this long voyage began to look at their women, and one by one the emaciated but handsome girls of the long black hair were led into the bushes and cherished, and strange multiple marriages were begun, and new life was launched on the island. But of the women, the fairest could not find her man, for Teroro was brooding by the sea, reflecting on the sacrifice of the slave and its dark portent for the new homeland. So Tehani left the cave and walked down to the sea, crying in vain, "Teroro, Teroro," until Mato, who so far had no woman of his own and who had sat close to Tehani all the way north, thus seeing her in many lights and appreciating her quality, heard her and ran through the woods until he could, as if by accident, encounter her along the shore. "Can't you find Teroro?" he asked casually. "No." "Perhaps he has important business," Mato suggested. "Where?" Tehani asked. "I don't know. Maybe." He took Tehani's hand and tried to lead her back into the trees through which he had just run, but she pulled away. "No," she insisted. "I am a chief's daughter and a chief's wife." "Are you Teroro's wife?" Mato chided. "What do you mean?" she demanded. her long hair flashing across her delicate breasts as she turned her head sharply. "I sat very near you on the trip, Tehani," Mato explained. "It didn't look to me as if Teroro thought of you as his wife." "I was taboo," she explained. "But thinking of you wasn't taboo," Mato said. "Teroro never thought of you, Tehani. I did." He took her hand again, and this time she held on to the rugged young chief, because she knew that what he said was true. "I am very alone," she confessed. "Do you know what I think, Tehani? I think you will never be Teroro's wife. I think he is hungry for his old wife, Marama." Since Tehani shared this suspicion, she experienced a moment of recognition and felt strongly drawn toward Mato and allowed him to pull her into the dark glade away from the shore and to slip her leafy skirt from her until in her nakedness she looked at him and realized how desperately she wanted this young man who did not reject her. And he, looking for the first time at her exquisite beauty, diminished though it had been by the voyage, felt a pang of sorrow that such a girl should have been given to a man who did not want her. Gathering her in his arms, he whispered, "You are my woman, Tehani." But when she actually felt his body against hers, and when she heard his words, she grew afraid, for she knew that she was not his woman, and she broke away and ran back to the beach, adjusting her skirt as she went. Before Mato could overtake her, she saw Teroro and ran up to him, crying nervously, "You must make peace with your brother." And she led her husband back along the ocean front, past where Mato stood bitterly watching her, and onto the plateau where King Tamatoa surveyed the rude temple. At first, neither man spoke, but Teroro, looking over his brother's shoulder, could see the ominous stones resting on fresh earth. He was dismayed, but said grudgingly, "This is an appropriate temple, brother. Later we will build a better." The king nodded, and it was then that Tehani of the long tresses and the flashing eyes led her bewildered husband into the darkness, knowing in her heart that it was another who should have accompanied her. The sexual life of the king was much too important to be conducted in darkness and hidden glades. So on the next day, after the fishermen had brought in their first substantial catch, and women had boiled their unpromising pandanus drupes, Tupuna announced that his wife Teura had ascertained that the time of the month was propitious, and that their king Tamatoa would that afternoon lie with his wife Natabu. That grave and stately woman was then brought forth from beneath a tree where she had been secluded, and a temporary shelter made of cut saplings stuck into the ground and covered with the most consecrated tapas, was erected according to ancient custom. When the tent was completed, sedate Natabu, who rarely spoke, and who was, by a peculiar combination of omens and good circumstances, the most holy of all the voyagers, was blessed by Tupuna, and led into the nuptial area, and placed, according to ancient custom, upon the woven mats. The king was then blessed, and the entire company, including even the five slaves, surrounded the tapa house and chanted. Then, with the prayers and blessings of all the community, the king was taken to the sanctified house, placed inside by the priest, and hidden by the lowered tapa. At this point, the prayers mounted in frenzy. The woman with whom the king lay was his sister Natabu. It had been discovered anciently in the islands that, for a king to breed a proper heir to the throne, one who would combine the finest lineage and the utmost sanctity, he must mate only with his full-blood sister. And although both Tamatoa and his sister Natabu might later take other spouses, their principal obligation was the production, under circumstances of the most intricate propriety and under the surveillance of the entire community, of royal descendants. "May the union be fruitful," old Teoro chanted as her niece and nephew lay inside the tapa tent. "May it produce strong kings and princesses, blessed with godlike blood." The crowd prayed, "May this union produce for us a king." And although they had prayed thus on occasion in the past, when the nuptial tent had been raised over Tamatoa in hopes of breeding an heir, they had never prayed with equal fervor. For it was apparent that in a strange land, an heir of the most impeccable lineage was essential. For who else could represent them before the gods if Tamatoa died? In the late afternoon, when the king and his sister left the rude tent, the eyes of the people followed them, and the chants continued, and all prayed that a good thing had been accomplished on that auspicious day. When the nuptial tent was taken down, and all omens pertaining to it examined, King Tamatoa faced another major obligation, for he was led by Tupuna to a field into which the farmers had diverted a small stream. This would become the taro bed upon which the community would depend for its basic food, and already the mud walls surrounding it imprisoned a foot of water, making the bottom of the field a deep, soft mass of mud. Standing at the edge where the stream entered, Tamatoa cried, "May the manna of my body pass through my feet and bless this field." Whereupon he stepped knee-deep into the muddy water and began trampling the bed. He was joined by Tupuna, Tiroro, Mato, and Pa, the men with most manna, and for hours they passed back and forth over every inch of the taro patch, hammering the mud into a watertight basin, sealing it with their manna. When they were done, Tamatoa shouted, "May this bed be forever sealed. Now plant the taro." And according to customs more than 2,000 years old, the people planted not only the taro, but the breadfruit and the bananas and the pandanus. But for no crop were they as fearful of failure as when they planted coconuts, for to a large extent their entire manner of life was intertwined with this extraordinary tree. When the nuts were young, they gave delicious water. When old, a precious oil or a sweet milk. Palms from the coconut thatched many of the houses. Hard shells formed cups and utensils. Fibers from the husks yielded sennit. Timber from the trunk was used for building and for carving gods. The wiry fiber that grew in the crown was woven into fabric. Ribs of the fronds, when dried, were suitable for starting fires, and sharper ribs from the leaves were used in making darts. But most of all, the coconut gave food, and the vocabulary of these people contained 28 different names for the maturing stages of this marvelous nut. From the time when it contained a just-formed jelly-like substance eaten with scoops by the old or ill, to the day when it was a firm, sweet nut. Therefore, when a coconut was planted, the people placed about the nut a baby octopus to hold the resulting tree erect, and prayed, "May the king have done a good job this day." When the crops were planted, a question arose as to what the island should be named, and the warriors, who knew little of omens, agreed that it ought properly to be called Bora Bora. But a great surprise was in store for them, for when Tupuna of the ancient main heard the report, he was outraged. "There is only one name."